Plugs Play Pedagogy. This is episode 2, Attack of the Cloned Teaching Statements, recorded in September 2014. I'm Kyle Stedman from Rockford University, and I want to start with a story. You're on campus late at night. Your campus, the one where you teach. You're friends with someone in the archaeology department who invited you to check out the progress on a dig that's currently going on, a dig that's right below the center of campus. She said to meet her at the entrance to the underground tunnel, but when you got there, she wasn't there, so you just kind of stepped over the yellow tape and pushed open the door to the new tunnel. You figure she's probably inside already, so you go in. Using your phone as a flashlight, you walk down the dirt path, which goes on a lot longer than you expected. You pass this giant ball of rock that looks like it could crush someone if it got loose, and you see some graffiti that says Spike plus Drusilla. And to your shock, you even pass the skeleton of a man whose wallet identifies him as Chester Copperpot, whoever that is. Eventually, you arrive at a large room that opens up before you, with a huge chest in the middle. Picture the most stereotypical treasure chest ever, but bigger, with glowing yellow light sneaking out through the cracks. You look up at the dirt ceiling, and you figure you're probably right under the center of campus. You walk up to the chest, and you see a dusty old slate propped up in front of it. It reads, "Inside this magical chest are all the teaching philosophy statements ever written by faculty and graduate students associated with this campus. Once they're written, they magically appear in this chest through a magical sort of magic." Well, you've always felt like it was hard to write teaching philosophy statements, so you're delighted at this bounty of wisdom from throughout the ages. So you crack open the chest, and you find a single document. Wait, what? You thought the slate said that all the philosophy statements would be here. How could they all be on a single document? What sort of magical magic is this? Confused, you pull it out and you start to skim it. You see the phrases you expected: student-centered classroom, passionate about teaching, encourage critical thinking. Well, sure, of course those phrases are there. But where's the good stuff in the cracks between those cliched phrases, you wonder. But as you keep reading, you start to get a little bit afraid as you see more and more of those cliched phrases: discussion-centered, innovative, multimodal even, and over you see the word truly. Holy smokes, you say to yourself. This single document is the magical amalgamation of all the teaching statements since the school was founded, and they're all essentially the same? You scream. And you wake up. Oh, good, it was just a dream. But was it? Deep down, you're afraid that maybe it wasn't really a dream at all. What if the teaching philosophy statements really are too alike at your school and every school? That is what I'm here to talk to you about in this second episode ever of Plugs Play Pedagogy. We'll hear three different voices exploring teaching statements from all sorts of angles. And then I'll end with a couple of reading recommendations for those who have no idea where to start. And hopefully together, we'll escape the stifling tunnels of doom that lead these things to sound so, so cliche so, so often. Am I being overly dramatic? I might be a little over dramatic here, but whatever.
I just was advising a visiting instructor who's from another institution who wanted me to look over his job application materials. And when I got to his teaching philosophy, it was exactly what you said. You know, mm-hmm. I've read this before. You know, this does not make you stand out in any way.
Let me welcome you to part one, an interview I conducted with Laura Runge, graduate director and associate chair of the Department of English at the University of South Florida.
It was fine. You know, yeah. It described what he was doing in the classroom. It did not give me any sense that he understood what was happening in the classroom. Right. So I said to him, you know, you should punch this up a little bit by talking about what types of learning are taking place in your classroom, how you set up a classroom to deliver or to facilitate the type of learning that you're expecting. And he looked at me and he says, you know, I know I should do that, but I just don't know that.
So when you have the students in class, is it the same thing? Do they kind of look at you and say, I have nothing to say? What?
No, because by the end of the class, I hope they've thought about these things a little bit. But right. By that time, you're inundated with so many other people's ideas, and you're trying to put together a syllabus for your own that you're going to teach the next semester, presumably. And so it's really a reflective exercise. And I tell them, I don't want a methodology. Some mm-hmm. teaching philosophies are methodologies. And in job applications, I think you have to have a little bit of both, because you don't have an opportunity in some preliminary stages of the job interview process or the job application process to talk about how you teach. But the philosophy has to be also why you teach the way you do. And so by the end of the class, the students have actually produced some really remarkable documents. Mm-hmm. And I remember a couple of them that stand out. One in particular, and you probably know Taylor Joy Mitchell.
Yes.
Yes. She's a phenomenal teacher, but she took my assignment and took it in a direction I never saw before, and I haven't seen since. She decided not to write one teaching philosophy, but to write three.
All right.
And she wrote them to specific jobs. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, you know what? This makes sense, because teaching is not static.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in rhetoric, you know, it's often a chirotic event, right? You have
sure.
a specific moment that you're teaching to and a specific context. And if you try to abstract teaching from those particulars, it's nearly impossible to talk about what you believe in.
Now, I was talking to someone about this once who was on the job market about a year ago, and she felt a little embarrassed by the fact that she had two different, you know, kind of the one that's generally for the teaching schools and the one that's generally for the research schools. And then she would even fiddle with them a little bit more based on what she could find out. And she thought that was a little, could be seen as dishonest, but you're saying it more as this is the natural state of rhetoric. Of course that we shape our communication based on the audience.
Absolutely. And you shape your teaching based on the audience too. So why wouldn't you change your philosophy based on different requirements?
Of course, of course.
I really do think the word philosophy is the stumbling block, because we think of philosophy in some sort of universal abstract mm-hmm. way. And teaching is and is not those things, right? I mean, there are certain, when I write my own, if, mm-hmm. I don't know if we're going to get to that point, but when I write my own teaching philosophy for sure. whatever reason, for awards or other sorts of bureaucratic
of course.
Requirements, I often will just hit a highlight a bunch of bullets that really hit the principles that I use in a classroom, because mm-hmm. it's not something that is. And I write a sort of explanation at the beginning, but not all of these will apply in all instances. These are pretty much what I believe in all the time, but I don't always employ them. It right. depends on the situation.
So you made me think of two things there. One is I remember reading a piece in the Chronicle, I think it was about a year ago. I'll go back and edit this later if I'm wrong. And I think what it said was that the word philosophy in some ways kind of helped. If you called it a teaching statement, people thought they just had to state all sorts of things and just kind of list, I did this and I did this and I did this. But when you call it a philosophy, that suggests a little bit more of the reflective thinking, the let's put a name on it, let's categorize it, that you seem to be saying.
This is Kyle from the future. The article that I was slightly misremembering was Leonard Casuto's What's Your Teaching Philosophy? It was published in the Chronicle of Higher Education on December 2nd, 2013. He does talk a bit about the difference between the term teaching statement and teaching philosophy, though he has a much broader purpose in mind as well. Okay, back to the interview.
I would agree with that. Teaching statement is worse by far. You know, it sounds like, you know, well, I'm reviewing tenure files as well. And,
of course.
And so I see the people who have been working for the last 5 years, 6 years on their teaching. And that, you know, that's a record of what they've taught and the accomplishments they've had. You know, the philosophy is different, right? It's an articulation of ideals as well as the practical methods you use to reach them.
I like articulation of ideals because of course we're putting our best foot forward. That's what we're trying to do here. The other thing that struck me is you mentioned using bullet points, and I when I'm the one who's applying to jobs, and I know this because I went back and looked, I tend to write way too much, and of course so many of us do, and I went back and looked at my own teaching philosophy, and it's 2 pages single spaced. There are margins, and they're not like super small, but they're smaller than I think I would like to see on the other end. And that's one thing. When I was on my first English studies job committee last year, I was often annoyed just right away if it was long. I was like, oh no. And so I'm trying to think, I've heard some people say, don't you dare go over a page. I've heard people say, no, you really can't do it in one page. Do you lean one way or another in length and how much we ought to include?
Absolutely. And you know, I love teaching, and I love teaching about teaching, and I love pedagogical subjects, but don't go over a page. Give your reader a break. I mean, if you can't convey the spirit and the essence of your teaching in a page, then, you know, you better be really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think you do want to avoid using the jargon, you know, the student-centered classroom. All right, so
yes.
What classroom isn't student-centered? If it's not, then you shouldn't be doing this.
Yes.
But at the same time, recognize what the ideal was before the cliche devolved, right? So that you can convey that through either examples of your methods or through a unique articulation of what it means to be a teacher whose main objective is to reach the students where they are.
Yes, I like that a lot. It's both in what you have to say and in how you articulate it.
Yeah, because I think I've read a lot of philosophy statements that are filled with jargon, and there's no sense to me that the teacher actually understands what that is supposed to mean.
Right. Well, I've kind of gone through the notes that I have jotted down. I don't know if there's anything else that you want to make sure people hear.
It is an important document, and I think that obviously if you're going to a school like yours, that if you're applying to a school like the one you are at,
yes,
you need to recognize the importance of teaching and have an understanding that the people who are reading this document are going to be good judges of teaching.
Right.
So that's one consideration. But then there are other jobs where there aren't, and that the primary consideration will be brevity, a sense of the experience that you have as a teacher,
sure.
A sense of a willingness to continue learning. I think that's also important. I think that, you know, one of the things I always say about teaching when I start my pedagogy course is that I have been teaching for X number of years, a couple decades now, and I always have something more to learn about teaching. Teaching is never static. It never stays the same. And when it does, then you're in danger, because mm-hmm. then you're going to lose the ability to reach the students. And yeah. So I think that the philosophy statement has to have an open-endedness as well as a sense of confidence and a sense of, you know, already experienced.
I like that idea of expressing confidence by leaving things open a little bit. You know,
yeah.
it's a sort of paradox. It's the sort of confidence that you have when you stick to one page. You don't feel like you have to go on and on and on just to assert how great you are. You can let some of that confidence just come through.
Yeah. So hopefully people who read or listen to your podcast will write these amazing teaching statements, and we won't have to read the bad ones anymore.
Exactly. I think that's that's the selfish part of this. I'm earlier in my career. I have a lot more to read.
Oh yeah.
This is a public service podcast.
That's right. That's right. We're gonna do good for our community.
You can follow Laura Runge on Twitter at Laura_Runge. That's like the word lunge with an R on it. Like if you were lunging for something, you're just runging for something instead. Get it? Okay. Now for part two. In my undisciplined Googling while planning this episode, I came across a delightful blog post on the topic by Karen Kelski from theprofessorisin.com. You'll see her called Dr. Karen on her site. I liked her post a lot because, naturally, she agrees with me that these statements are often, in her words, dreadful, painful, excruciating. Heck, yes, they are. Kelski gave me permission to edit and perform her post, the dreaded teaching statement, Eight Pitfalls. You can read the entire post and another post dedicated to the weepy teaching statement at theprofessorisin.com. For help on the reading side, I turned to my brilliant colleague, Tara Wood, assistant professor of English at Rockford University, just like me.
Error number one, it is too long. A teaching statement is always a subsidiary document to a larger job application, which already includes a job letter, a CV, references, and possibly a writing sample. It is simply not realistic or reasonable to expect the search committee to wade through a three-page, single-spaced teaching statement on top of all of that. While some dedicated individuals might, the vast majority will not. So, be your own best advocate and make your statement as easy as possible to digest. Believe me, everything you actually need to say in a teaching statement can be easily said in one page. And while we're on the subject, I don't mean one page in 11-point font with half-inch margins either. I mean one page with nice, creamy, 1-inch wide margins on all sides and a nice legible 12-point font that is easy on middle-aged eyes. White space on a page communicates expansiveness and confidence. Line upon line of minuscule font crammed up to the edges of the paper, by contrast, communicates insecurity and desperation. Error number two. You tell a story instead of making statements supported by evidence. This is probably the single most common pitfall of the teaching statement. For some reason, candidates think that genre requires the story of my teaching life. In other words,
I always like to use multiple media materials in the classroom. I first discovered the value of these when I taught Introduction to Cultural Anthropology at the Eastern Tennessee State last spring. In that class, I had the opportunity to use a wide range of videos and online materials. Students told me that they really loved these, and I came to feel that these are excellent methods for promoting in-class discussions. I plan to use them in future classes as well.
I'll bet some of you reading this post think that the above is totally great. It isn't. It's rambly and utterly enmeshed in the single greatest principle of bad writing, which is that it tells when it needs to show. We don't want the story of teaching. We want principles of teaching and evidence that you exemplify these principles in specific classroom goals and practices. This statement has to articulate a wide, general good that can be achieved through university pedagogy at its broadest level. Then the writer demonstrates in concrete and specific terms how this good is manifested in specific teaching strategies with examples. Then evidence is provided to show it was done effectively. Then there is a conclusion, and the essay is finished. Error number three. You express sentiments that are saccharine, obvious, and indistinguishable from countless other applicants. Now, following up on error number two, is the concurrent problem that all too often the wide general good that writers fall back on is sometimes tiredy, old, bloody blah about
encouraging discussion
and
promoting a variety of viewpoints
and
using a variety of multimedia materials
and
caring passionately about learning
and
creating engaged learners
and blah, blah, blah. I want to say very bluntly, do you understand that the search committee is reading something like 200 of these? And do you realize that of those 200, approximately 185 are going to say that the writer
cares passionately about teaching, uses a variety of multimedia materials, promotes discussion, and strives to educate students for the 21st century information society?
Seriously, do you really think these sentiments are original at this point in time? They aren't. The sentiments you express in your statement cannot be saccharine or hackneyed or obvious. You actually need to think about this as a profoundly original endeavor that springs from deeply held beliefs that are unique to you, coming from your particular life experiences, and that are not going to be automatically shared by others. Then you need to give actual examples from classes that you have taught, examples that are not painfully obvious, like,
I use small group discussions,
but rather truly vivid and memorable, like, I assigned mini ethnographies of the local meatpacking district, and then students shared these in a student symposium in the last week of the term. You must give at least one example that your readers will likely be able to say of later, oh yeah, she's the one who assigns the mini ethnographies of the meatpackers, right? Error number 4, you misread your audience. You may well have to write two teaching statements, one for a teaching-oriented, small, liberal arts college, and one for a research institution. These won't be wildly different, but they may differ to a degree. Your readers want evidence that your teaching goals at the highest level are consistent with the mission of the institution. If it is a SLAC, small liberal arts college, then you'll want to emphasize your passion for and successes in teaching small, intimate classes. If it's a giant land grant comprehensive, then you'll be best served by describing your enjoyment of an exceptional success and using innovative methods to teach a lecture course of 300 students. Error number 5. You are excessively humble, especially if you are a female. It may seem charming and engaged to use language like this. I was honored to have the opportunity to be entrusted with the core seminar in X subject. I was fortunate to be selected for the award in Y topic. I hope that my methods will encourage students, ... I am always striving to improve my skills and seek training in new methods. But it is in fact overly submissive and self-sabotaging. At the tenure-track job search level, search committees are looking for powerful and accomplished professionals in the classroom. It is not an honor and a privilege to teach. It is a basic responsibility of a scholarly job. Speak of it as such. Error number 6. You are excessively emotional, especially if you are female. It may seem friendly and engaged to use language like this. I am delighted when students tell me, I would be thrilled to teach your course in ... I am so excited to use new materials. It would be a great pleasure to create new courses. I can't say enough about how much I enjoy ... But it is actually overly emotional and highly feminized in ways that, again, are self-sabotaging on the tenure-track job market. Women in particular must beware of their tendency to overinvest in a nice persona in their teaching statements. Teaching at the tenure track level is not about being nice. It is about being a professional. Realize that the nicer and sweeter you sound, the more you are characterizing yourself as the classic female perennial one-year replacement adjunct. Those who are competitive in the tenure track market, by contrast, articulate a teaching persona that is completely consistent with their researcher persona. Serious, intellectually hard-hitting, disciplinarily cutting-edge, demanding, and with high standards and expectations. Error number 7. You fail to link your research and teaching into a single consistent whole. In an earlier post on my blog, I introduced the sentence, "The same commitment to blank that propels my research also inspires my teaching." This sentence sums up the appropriate attitude with which to approach a teaching statement. The teaching statement is not meant to suddenly depart from your scholarly persona to tell a random news story about how nice you are and how much you care about students. The teaching statement is meant to demonstrate that you are as self-directed, resourceful, innovative, and original in the classroom as you are in your research and writing. The connections between these personas should be utterly seamless. If you are dedicated to new approaches to medieval manuscripts in your research, then show us how you use medieval manuscript copies in your classroom to instruct students in paleographic methods. If you are dedicated to critiquing new U.S. ideologies of adolescence and capital in your research, then show how you have students deconstruct specific episodes of The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody on deck. If you study the role of death in Shakespearean drama, then show how you have your students stage one of the corpse scenes from Hamlet. Remember to always stay on message. Error number 8. You don't have a conclusion. All professional documents should conclude with a broad and expansive gesture toward the wider import of your work, dribbling off with a line like, "And I received positive feedback for that class," is painfully deflating to read. End on a strong note. An example might be, "In sum, all of my pedagogical strategies are dedicated to teaching the principles of humanistic research in dynamic, hands-on ways that will remain with the student long after he or she leaves my classroom." Or, "To conclude, whether in small classes or large, I am dedicated to bringing the insights of political science to students' lived experience, both at the local and global level." In sum, your teaching statement should be short, evidence-based, distinctive and memorable, appropriately tailored, confident, factual, not emotional, consistent with your scholarly persona, wrapped up with a conclusion.
You can hear more of Karen Kelski's advice at theprofessorisin.com or on Twitter at @professorisin.
You know, if you're especially a new kind of minted PhD and you're on the market for the first time, and you're more than likely applying to 20, 30, 40 jobs, depending on what your strategy is.
At least.
These aren't things that you can constantly tweak in digital media for each committee, like you might be able to do with some of the print materials.
That was Kathy Gossett, Assistant Professor of Digital Humanities and Human Computing Interaction at Iowa State University, and also conference chair at SIGDOC in just a couple of weeks. That's the Special Interest Group on Design of Communication. If you play Seize the Day at 4Cs, there's a trading card for that conference, just so you know, if you know what I'm talking about. Here in part three, I want to share an interview I conducted with Kathy on all sorts of things. Really, this is just a snippet of our conversation, but I especially wanted to hear her advice on how digital scholars can approach the teaching statement from their particular point of view.
You know, even if you're great and you're one of those applicants who does research and figures out all of those things about the committee, thinking about redoing a video 20 times for different audiences exhausting.
Right. Well, and I really like that we're talking about this in the bigger picture, how it's part of your professional ethos overall as someone who maybe did a digital dissertation, maybe didn't, but as someone who's situating yourself as a digital person in general. This is how you represent all of your teaching online, not just how you write or create some kind of a statement, it sounds like.
Right, absolutely. One of the things that I am a real proponent of is that if you do use technology in your classroom and you consider yourself a digital scholar and a digital teacher, you do need to be able to represent that online and have some kind of a stance online that shows the work that you do. But one of the ways that I tried to approach it, and I'm not sure it's necessarily the best way, but it seemed to work for me, was that I had links to assignments that had been mediated in one way or another. And then in addition to those assignments, I had student permission to post a couple of student examples so I could show the work that I got in response to that. And then sometimes I would put a little kind of commentary thinking about what worked with that assignment or not. And it can take a little bit of thinking ahead to get some idea, you know, permissions from students to post these things, or maybe looking behind and trying to scramble and find some students that will give you permission.
it makes me think how from my first my 2-year review, I got permission from students to share some of my like audio responses to essays and video responses to essays. But you're making me now realize how that was kind of just me. That was, hey, look at the stuff I know how to do, but I wasn't showing off what the students can do. It was really showing me in this position of look how good a critiquer I am.
Mm-hmm. Kind of going to my assignments that I have on my teaching with technology classes, one of the questions you asked is, why do I have students remediate their philosophy statement?
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is because I ask them to use technologies that they will potentially be teaching with that they may or may not have had an opportunity to experiment with in other classes. Mm-hmm. So My teaching with technology classes are always kind of a theory and production course, so students have time to work on it. It's one of the things that I've found in my other research for digital dissertations is that there are quite a few students who would like to do these things, but the opportunities to learn the tools are not there in graduate school. It's either something you have to learn on your own, or it's something that, you know, is kind of seen as other.
And you're making me think about how it's safer in some ways. I think it feels safer to me to tell students that I just know enough to be dangerous, that I'm figuring this out with them, that they might know more. It seems safer to say that to them than to a search committee. And I'm going back to that idea of the search committee member who sees the printed document that says, go to my website to see this in action, to see these digital artifacts, and doesn't want to take the time. So I'm trying to think, how do I, and I know you don't have an answer, but I'm wondering how do I express the right kind of confidence that doesn't go into arrogance, that doesn't go into I'm promising more than I know how to do with a search committee, especially if I have to do that on paper. You know, it's such a hard rhetorical situation.
Yeah, and that's, you know, you raise a good point there. You do have to be able to figure out how to represent your skill level in a rhetorically effective way, because the last thing you want to do is get to a campus visit, and if you've represented that you know how to do something and one of the members of the committee happens to know that kind of video or audio so well and ask you a question, you know, you don't want to get stuck on something either.
Sure.
Although there's always that deer in the headlights. I know how to do this.
Well, have you worked with graduate students on remediating these statements before? Have you worked with graduate students on print ones? How do they do? What do they struggle with?
Well, I think they struggle with the teaching philosophy in general. And, you know, it's one of those genres that we don't really teach. And, I mean, Phil Alexander and Danielle DeVos, and a few others had a great article in Computers and Composition in 2012, I believe, kind of on this topic about thinking about how under-theorized teaching philosophies are and under-taught. And so it's a genre that we don't really teach, and it's a genre that we don't really practice except for once or twice in our lives when we write it initially, and then when we go back to maybe update it for review or tenure, or if we're going to, you know, look for a second or third job or however our career is going. So I think that's one of the challenges. It's not a genre that we're really familiar with as graduate students, or even I would say as faculty. I know that when I first went to write my first one, I just looked at a ton of examples, and they were so different. You know, there were so many different examples of how to do them, and ones kind of like you said that kind of stood up and surprised you and made you think, and others it was like, oh, okay, there's the requisite quote from such and such a scholar, and right. You know, those ideas. And I think I have worked with students. I've worked with a couple of students as they've gone on the market. And then I've taught this teaching with technology class several times. And I think to me that the point that I try and make to students is to think about, this is a very personal document in a lot of ways. That it's really the opportunity that we have to reflect who we are as an instructor, and not to really shy away from that, to really own that as this is what I think and this is what I do. And it's not necessarily, I mean, you want to show that you're familiar with the pedagogical moves and literature. But it's not something that you really want to remove yourself from. Like so many of the ones that I read are written in third person and very formal. And I understand that that's one way to approach it. But those aren't the ones, I think, like you said, those aren't the ones that really stand out and get my attention and make me want to know more about this instructor. And so the first thing I have students do, actually, is I have them try writing it in first person.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes even that surprises them, kind of the ideas that they are willing to put in first person that they maybe weren't willing to put in third person, right? Because maybe they can't afford it with a quote or something like that. And so that's usually kind of the first remediation we do. After we kind of, we discuss, you know, what is the purpose? So what is the purpose of the teaching philosophy? Well, it has a purpose that you're supposed to talk about what you do, but you all, it also has the purpose of you're supposed to engage your audience and get them to agree with what you do or think what you do is great. And again, it's hard to, you're never going to know exactly who your audience is, right? So it's, yeah. I mean, it's a difficult document all around, and it's the one thing that I will say definitely about it that I talk to students a lot about is, you know, this is something that you have to draft and draft and draft. It's yes. not something that your first or second draft is going to be, you know, done with. You know, I have the students, my goal of having students remediate it in the class is, like I said before, to kind of experiment with softwares that they maybe haven't used before. And again, I can't claim that this is my original idea. I think I found it in a syllabus from Danielle DeVos back in 2007 or 2008 and thought, what a great idea. And I've kind of, kind of riffed on it in certain ways. So I have them go first from like the third person to the first person. So they animate it first. So they need to use some kind of a piece of software to animate it in some way, shape, or form. Cool. Then we do a sound version. There's also a presentation version in there. And then we end up at a video. And I change it up. We also do a purely visual, no text allowed nice. Version of it. And my goal there is to really get students to think about not only how they want to, you know, not only kind of their ideas about the philosophies of teaching that they have and what kinds of different like visuals can represent it rather than textual, but to actually think about how these media change the way we can think about these things, right? How does saying you can only use images and no words make you think about this statement in a different way, or does it?
Well, and it's so funny that the things you're saying are things that I tell my students all the time, right? I kind of say, just please play around and play around with this different modality, this different medium. Let's see what happens, and let's see if we like it, and then we can judge it. But we have to play around first. And here you are saying the same thing, but I wonder how often I tell myself that. You know, it's something that I say more than I listen to.
Yeah, well, it's playing is not necessarily comfortable. It's not something that we do in graduate school.
Right. You're making me think of, this might be a tangent, it might not, but I know when I was working for the FYC program when I was in graduate school, part of what I was hoping and trying to get this group of like 70 graduate student instructors to do was share more, to say, hey, you came up with this thing you did in class. Will you just upload it to this folder? Will you let me ask you about it so I can write about it in a blog? We're all doing all this stuff and we're all reinventing the wheel over and over and over. And you know, some people were better at others, and I know I wasn't always as good at it at sharing as I said, told other people they should be. But I did eventually definitely get some people say pretty point blank that, well, that's my stuff and I came up with that and I really don't want everyone else using it. And I've never forgotten that. So is that related here? Is there something where all of a sudden we're being maybe more than we like to think, we've been used to doing things and are kind of solitary addicts on our own computers? Yes, we go to class. Yes, we talk to our mentors, but a lot of it might come down to what I do alone. And all of a sudden this is very public. All of a sudden we're writing for a real audience. All of a sudden we're saying, look at my documents and my examples. And I wonder if that's hard for some people. I mean, I think that was probably hard for me.
Yeah. I haven't had that problem. I've had the problem with students not wanting to have something that's not perfect out there for other folks to find.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that I try and talk about to my students, but again, it's not necessarily something that's comfortable for me as a professional stance either, is sometimes, you know, highlighting our failures are the things that we learn the most from and the things that we can teach others the most with. I know, like, I remember one of my early syllabi that I tried to incorporate media in was just an absolute abysmal failure. It was just horrific. I was a third year graduate student, putting things in that I'd read about that I thought would be great to try.
We've all been there. No, I know.
It exploded. And I remember talking to my mentor at the time. He just looked at me and said, "That's great. I'm so glad you had that experience." And I was like, "What, are you making fun of me?" It's like, no, it might be, you might look at it now as the most colossal mistake you've ever made, but you learn from it. That's what you'll learn from. You don't learn from the syllabi and the courses that go right year after year after year, and you don't push yourself. It's the ones that kind of implode, and then you have to think about it and really theorize and kind of think what went wrong and how do I make it right, that's really going to keep making you pushing you to be a better and better teacher. And I don't see a whole lot of scholarship out there about, here's my first attempt and it was a failure and here's where I ended up and this is why.
I think that's related to, we need more scholarship that shows the process of things from the very beginning, including the failures in anything. Here's how this got made. I'm not just going to show you this clean, perfect product.
Right. It's one of the reasons why I really like the Inventio section of Kairos. And I wish that happened more often, but I also understand, it's published more often, but I also understand that it's not, because it does take that time. And the other thing that is very important, and I stress in all of my classes, and I can't stress it enough, is that we learn to figure out how to use technology when it's appropriate. We don't use technology for technology's sake. So we don't just use a video because everyone's making a video, or we decide for this, to check something off on our CV that we need to make a video of something. We really need to be thinking about, is video the most appropriate? If it's not, then what is the other, what are the other options? And sometimes print is the best option. If you do consider yourself someone who does digital pedagogy, and that's the way that you want to represent yourself, you really do need to have a digital presence. Even if committees don't end up looking at it, for the committees that do end up looking at it, and I think for your personal ethos, I think that they are really important. I get surprised every year at how many applicants we get for various positions that don't have a digital ethos, that claim some kind of a digital pedagogy or work with digital work. And so I think that, if I were to say one thing to graduate students coming out is, as much time as you spend on the print version of letters and teaching philosophies and everything else, if you are a digital scholar, you need to spend just as much time, or if not more, on your digital portfolio and your digital work, and make sure that that's up to snuff and that it's something that you can be proud of and you want to have committees look at as well.
Yeah, and I remember, maybe this goes back to my fear of sharing thing in graduate school, which I didn't really realize until just now. But I remember I had put together a website when I was on the job market, but I remember this kind of nagging feeling of was it good enough? Did I do a good enough job? But I don't think I reached out and got the kind of feedback on that the way that I had other people read all of my print documents over and over and over. I never sat down next to someone and said, show me where you click first, and did some UX testing specifically on my site. And I think I could have.
Point. I don't think I did either. I know I didn't actually.
Yeah.
that's a good point. Our field is such a field of, we do so much with mentorship that even I think if you have folks on your committee, if you don't have anyone on your committee that does that, I think that there's plenty of people that are approachable that would be willing to do that with you. But yeah, I mean, and here I am, I teach usability and user experience, and I never thought about doing that for my own website, like you said.
But it's true. I think we are the best field. I think we have the nicest people. I've been kind of shocked at the generosity of senior scholars. I mean, that's why I keep going to computers and writing, is specifically because, you make those relationships and it gets addicting.
I love our field.
That was Kathy Gossett, who you can follow on Twitter at GossettPhD. That's Gossett with two S's and two T's. Way, way, way back at the beginning of this episode, I promised a couple of suggested readings for people who have been entirely freaked out by this conversation. Usually when it comes to job search stuff, I turn to Catherine Hume's book, Surviving Your Academic Job Hunt, Advice for Humanities PhDs. For goodness sakes, why don't you have that book? But in this case, Hume is relatively silent, writing just a couple of paragraphs on the genre of the teaching statement. So where do we go next? I'm not the expert, and you can probably find tons of stuff on your own through your own Googling and through conversations with your mentors and friends. But here's where I would start. First, of course, there's Cheryl Ball. If you're on the job market, you need to know jobs.ceball.com, which is full of the practicalist advice out there. And oh, look, there's even a solid page on teaching statements there with very practical, here's what each paragraph can do. Maybe even should do. I hesitated because I wasn't sure if she would say can or should. It can slash should do. Cheryl also writes regularly for Inside Higher Education on job search stuff. You should read her, and you should read her often. Second, of course, you'd be smart to poke around the professorisin.com for suggestions, not just on teaching statements, but again, for wider job search material type stuff. And third, to understand the genre better and for a pretty awesome references list, you can't do better than the computers and composition piece that Kathy Gossett mentioned in part three of this episode. Specifically, it's a piece called Teaching with Technology, Remediating the Teaching Philosophy Statement from Computers and Composition, issue 29, released in 2012. It's by a congregation of smart people, a slew of them, a murder of, not a murder of them, but you know, there's a lot of smart people. They are, in alphabetical order, Phil Alexander, Carissa Shabbat, Matt Cox, Danielle Nicole DeVos, Barb Gerber, Stacey Perryman Clark, Julie Platt, Donnie Johnson Sackey, and Mary Wendt. Check it out. And with that, the show is finally over. Finally, right? I'm Kyle Stedman from Rockford University, and as you can tell, I can't do the show on my own. I need your ideas, your skills, your show segments, your dreams and plans and frustrations and mixtapes. So please contact me. I'll keep an eye on the Plugs Play hashtag on Twitter, where I'm at kstedman. That's K-S-T-E-D-M-A-N. You can also email me at plugsplaypedagogy@writingcommons.org. I think my next episode may focus on the topic of readings. What do we assign students to consume outside of class? Why do we assign it? What works, what doesn't, and so on. If you have a story, you're ethically obligated to share it with me because I say so. Plugs Play Pedagogy is produced in cooperation with the amazing people at Kairos Cast and Writing Commons. If you Google those names, you won't regret it. The podcast is licensed by a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 4.0 International License, and you can Google that too. Our theme music is by Cactus May, graduate student in rhetoric and composition at Ohio University. Find more of his work at heycactus.weebly.com. As always, you also heard some video game remixes that are freely available at ocremix.org. In the Green Gloom by Argle, that's A-R-G-L-E, and Xanarkand String Quartet, arranged by Gray Fox 1217. Now you're hearing Blue Lightning by Disco Dan. I'm Kyle Stedman from Rockford University, recording in Rockford, Illinois, where the tree outside my office has just started to hint at showing some red leaves. This is Plugs Play Pedagogy.